diving, snagging her friend by the legs and pulling her back onto the platform so she couldn't fall through. It happened so fast that the crowd didn't make a sound. Agatha stayed on her knees, hugging Kiko's calves with all of her strength as Kiko hung from the noose at an angle. If Agatha let her go, her friend would drop and break her neck. Which meant both of them were trapped in their position.
"Don't leave me,"
Sophie heard Kiko whimper. "I won't," Agatha assured.
"Bad things happen when you leave me," Kiko said. "Bad things happen to all of us."
"Your turn,"
a voice said. Sophie looked up to see the snake glaring at her. He held out the deck of cards. There was a flatness in his eyes, a ruthless insistence on the rules of the game, as if he knew precisely how it would end.
"Pick,"
he said. Sophie did. The card was Nicholas. Across the platform, Nicola's trapdoor opened. In a flash, Sophie sprinted across the stage and tackled the first year just before she fell through, shoving her to the side of the opening and holding her by the ankles. Sophie looked up and saw Nicola goggling at her, Agatha too.
"Guess we're friends now,"
Sophie said to Nicola. With no sign of Tedros, the crowd revolted, battering the walls with renewed force. Suddenly, 30 young pirates broke through the crowd, seizing the hardest protesters from behind, swords to their necks. The rest of the mob went quiet with fear.
"It seems we have a dilemma,"
the snake continued, watching the two girls in opposite corners clutching their friends.
"Because someone has to pick next."
Neither girl budged. The terrified crowd glanced between them and the snake.
"Ah, I see," the snake said. "It seems you're both a bit tied up. Well then."
He held out the deck in his open palm.
"I'll pick."
He turned the first card over. Hort. Sophie and Agatha whirled to each other. Either one of them had to let go of their friend, or Hort would hang.
"Go,"
Nicola said to Sophie.
"No, stay,"
Hort cried. Tears fogged Sophie's eyes. She couldn't watch Hort die. His trapdoor opened. The noose around his neck yanked tight. Sophie and Nicola screamed. Instantly, the rest of the prisoners in the row kicked their legs out, using the chain cuffed across them to swing like a five-headed dragon. Hester, Anadil, Willem, Bogdan, and finally Dot, who thrust her legs and caught Hort's backside with her shins before he fell through the door. With every ounce of strength, she held him up by the tailbone, their bodies planked at right angles like trapeze performers mid-flight. Sophie buckled in relief, briefly losing grip of Nicola, but catching her just in time. Hort was dripping sweat, rope burns around his neck.
"Thanks, Dot,"
he croaked. "Don't thank me. Thank Uncle Miyazaki," Dot panted, smiling over at Nicola. She looked back at Hort.
"Though I'll take a date too, if you're offering."
Hort coughed. The snake watched all of this, his body still, his green mask obscuring any reaction except for his winnowing blue eyes.
"So much for the rules of the game,"
he said, With a flourish, he flung the cards into the air, dozens of painted faces glinting in green glow as they fluttered to the stage. Sophie locked eyes with Agatha. Their hearts stopped. Every trap door started to magically open, all the prisoners about to drop through. The crowd reeled, preparing for mass carnage. Suddenly, fire-tipped arrows bombed down from the sky, just missing the snake and igniting the wooden platform. The snake swiveled, taken by surprise, the gallows doors still half open. In the distance, the mob parted a path as two figures in buckskin tunics blazed through, astride a red-spotted deer. A blonde shooting arrows from a bow as someone behind, dark-skinned with long brown hair, lit arrows on fire with her purple finger glow. They were being chased by at least 50 bellowing pirates with swords and spears, trying to catch up with the sprinting deer. Sophie recognized the riders at once. "Beatrix and Rena," Sophie marveled. And the deer was... Millicent, Agatha realized. More of Beatrix's arrows rained over the wall, aimed at the snake. He split into a thousand squealing skims, dispersing like leeches to elude them. Re-energized, the crowd came to Beatrix's and Rena's defense, rushing headlong at the pirates, while on stage flames from the missed arrows started to spread. Agatha whirled to Sophie. Fire kills the skims, just like fire killed Rafal's zombies. She grabbed one of Beatrix's missed arrows and lit Kiko's noose, searing away the shrieking eel and setting her classmate free. Kiko blubbered, "I thought I was going to die, and then I would see my beautiful Tristan up there in heaven, and I would say, 'Kiko,'" Agatha said, glaring at all the prisoners still hanging. "Good point," said Kiko. Like a rabbit, Kiko dashed across the blazing stage, grabbing arrows out of the wood and lighting the scaly nooses on fire along with the chains between prisoners, starting with Nicholas.
"I have no idea who you are, but Sophie doesn't help anyone unless they're important," Kiko cheeped before burning through Nicola's cuffs, which let Sophie drop the first year to the stage, grab one of Kiko's arrows, and start helping the others in the row, while Agatha took the second and third rows.
"Hurry, Sophie!" Agatha cried as she freed the young princes of Jaunt Jolie. "The fire is spreading!" Sophie ran to Hort first, but out of the side of her eye she glimpsed Beatrix and Rena outside the iced walls, cornered by the pair of young pirates they'd seen kicking cages in Castle Jolie. The boys had stripped the Evergirls of their bows and arrows and were aiming the arrows back at their heads. Beatrix and Rena leapt off Millicent and hewed together, confronting the pirates with lit fingers.
"Manwolf, now!"
Sophie ordered Hort as she freed him.
"Aye, aye, Captain,"
Hort said, lighting his finger glow and bursting out of his breeches a mighty, hairy beast, before scaling the Camelot flagpole in a single bound and belly-flopping onto the pirates with a howl. As Kiko, Nicola, and the other freed prisoners helped burn away more nooses, Sophie felt Agatha seize her from behind.
"The whole stage will collapse,"
Agatha said, covering her mouth from the smoke.
"We have to get everyone out of here."
Sophie squinted up at the high walls that sealed them into the forepoint, while the war against the pirates raged beyond them.
"But how can we get them over that?"
"Leave it to me,"
Hester grunted, prying between the girls, finger glow lit. The tattooed demon on her neck engorged with blood, turning redder, redder, until it tore out of its chains and flew off her skin, swelling to three-dimensional life. Mumbling hissy gibberish, it began snatching prisoners from the stage three at a time, starting with kings and queens, and ferrying them over the walls and to the ground beyond, where throngs of citizens shielded them and spirited them back towards their kingdoms.
"Move faster, Hester!"
Agatha cried as the witch directed the demon with her glow from inside the four-point. Stage is burning up!
And I'm on the stage, so believe me when I say I'm moving as fast as I can,
Hester berated. Eyes watering from the smoke, Sophie weaved around the fires, intending to free Mona and Brone next. But now she saw Hort's man-wolf slammed up against the glass wall in front of her by tattooed Thiago, who'd pinned the tip of his pirate blade against Hort's hairy belly.
Knew I'd seen your grubby little face before, Thiago seethed. Scowry, son. Bragged ye'd be the first man-wolf pirate at Hook's Parley years ago. Took a blood oath to help us fight the Lost Boys. Instead ye turn round and kill Hook's captain like your Pan's stooge. Ye killed my father.
He dug his blade into Hort's stomach, drawing drops of blood.
Should have bragged ye'd be the first, Fink. I did what any true man would have, unlike your lot.
Hort growled in pain.
You kill for money. You follow a leader with no soul. You're the real Lost Boys.
Thiago cut him deeper.
Fleet's a pirate who killed one of his own. What I killed wasn't your father,
Hort insisted.
Tell yourself all the lies ye want,
Thiago smiled.
But this I know for sure. The thing I'm about to kill is you.
He gripped the sword hilt to run Hort through, but Hort grabbed the blade by the tip and muscled it away from his stomach, the steel slicing into his hand. Before Thiago could react, Hort slapped him across the head as hard as he could with his big, hairy palm. The pirate wheeled wildly, swinging his sword and biting it into Hort's bicep, spattering the frozen wall with blood and obscuring Sophie's view. Spinning around, Sophie saw Hester's demon had rescued nearly all the prisoners from the stage, with only her, Agatha, Hester, Anadil, and Dot left. On the battlefield, Willem, Bogdan, Beatrix, Rena, and Nicola were fighting pirates with weapons flung at them by fleeing citizens. Hester's demon swooped to rescue Sophie, his beady eyes flashing.
Looky, missy witchy fishy.
No, take the witches, Sophie said, ducking his grab. You three, go help Hort. The witches gaped at Sophie, then at Agatha, as if they didn't trust Sophie could possibly be deferring her own rescue. Go! Agatha cried. Immediately the three witches hooked onto the demon's claws and flew up and over the walls. As he streaked down, Hester's demon attacked Thiago, blasting red firebolts from the demon's mouth, while Anadil's rats grew 20 feet tall and crashed into the fray, rampaging through pirates as the three witches rode on the rats' backs, shooting stun spells right and left. On stage, Sophie and Agatha were the only two left behind, pushed to the edge by the fires. Aggie, we don't have time for the demon to come back, Sophie said. It's spreading too fast. Maybe this'll work, said Agatha, thrusting her glowing fingertip into the air. Heavy rain started falling over the four-point, dousing the blaze. It was one of Agatha's trusty spells from her first year at school. Then, all of a sudden, the fires seemed to grow stronger in the rain, the orange flames turning a glowing emerald green. Agatha's eyes bulged. What in the... But now, there was something falling towards them straight out of the sky. A deer bounding over the wall, hoof-tip glowing red and landing on the stage, which half-crumbled like a giant sinkhole, before the deer recovered, lurching for the two girls. Come on, get on my back, Millicent said. Sophie and Agatha leapt onto her just as the gallows imploded in the green flames. Millicent sprinted for the walls, her legs tensing with power, about to magically propel over the barrier. Something slammed into Sophie and Agatha like harpoons, bashing them off the deer's back and pinning them into opposing walls. Skims. They glued down the girl's wrists and legs and spread them against the inside of the glass like mice caught in a trap. Petrified, Sophie swung her head towards Agatha, the two of them struggling against the scaly black eels. At the center of the stage, the snake reformed again, rising out of the green bonfire like a phoenix. Millicent charged for him, hurtling over the holes in the stage. The snake calmly peeled one of the skims off his chest, which rolled up in his palm like a tiny tube. Instantly, it turned to shiny black steel, razor sharp at both ends. Millicent leapt, hooves aimed at his chest, poised to crush him. The snake hurled the skim at her, spearing the deer in the heart. She fell down dead and burnt up in the green flames. Outside the walls, the students saw Millicent fall and stopped fighting, paralyzed in horror. The pirates seized them at once, knives and swords to their throats. With a pirate's dagger to her own neck, Hester stalled her demon, as did Anadil her rats, afraid to cost any more friends their lives. Hort gnashed his teeth, feeling Thiago's sword point on his spine, poised to slice him open. Nicola, Bogdan, Dot, and Willem were all trapped by pirates, along with the rest of the questing Evers and Nevers. On stage, the snake was circled in green flames like a ringmaster. His eyes shifted between Sophie and Agatha, pressed against the glass on either side of him, as if he was deciding which girl to handle first. Instead, he pulled two skims off his body, one in each hand, letting them morph into steel-black blades. Slowly, he raised both arms, extended outwards, each blade aimed at a girl's heart. "This was how I died," Sophie thought. Rafal had killed her with a shot to the heart before Agatha had woken her with true love's kiss. But this time there would be no kiss, because her true love was about to die with her. The snake gripped the blades and coiled to throw. A roar exploded through the land, so full and deep it shook the earth. The snake stilled, the green flames cooling around him. Sophie and Agatha gaped at each other. Again came the roar, this time louder than before, shattering the iced wall between the two girls. Jagged shards rained over the snake, who turned away, shielding himself. As he looked back up, so did Sophie, craning her head to see through the wall. Someone was coming towards the stage, galloping through the crowd on a white horse, his body tall and muscular, in a dark blue jacket with a brilliant gold pattern, dark blue riding pants, and gold-lined boots. He was wearing a mask of gold that glimmered in the moonlight and shrouded his face. The mask of a lion. As his horse accelerated towards the stage, the lion-masked figure rose, feet sturdy in the stirrups, and climbed to stand on the horse's back, the reins in his hands. Then he lowered into a crouch, balanced on the horse's hide as if surfing a wave, and just as the horse started to buck him off, he jumped from the animal, sailing through the air like a ball from a cannon, through the busted ice wall and onto the gallows stage. As he stood to full height, he thrust out his finger like a wand, lighting the tip up with hot gold glow and illuminating the stage. Sophie saw Agatha's eyes widen. Only one person they knew had that glow, a glow that matched his true love's. Tedros. The crowd exploded with cheers. The lion had come. Across the stage, Sophie saw Agatha stop resisting her skims. All this time, Agatha had tried to fight Tedros's battles on his behalf, but now he'd come to wrest back control of his quest from his princess. Sophie could see Agatha sigh with exhaustion and relief, as if, at last, her fairy tale with Tedros was back on track, there ever after, salvaged from the ashes. Slowly, Agatha looked up and met the lion's aqua-blue eyes. Camelot's princess smiled, even though she was squashed against a wall like a fly in a spider's web, even though there was a deadly villain still on the stage. Sophie knew that smile. It was the smile of love. The lion and the snake faced off on a charred heap of ruins, all that remained of the stage. They circled each other inside a ring of dying green flames.
"This is Camelot's land,"
said the lion in his low, strapping voice.
"To which I have a rightful claim,"
the snake returned, chilly and sure. His opponent peered through his lion mask.
"And what gives you that right?"
"My birth,"
said the snake, casting shadows in the green light.
"I am the true heir to Camelot's throne. I am King Arthur's eldest son."
This last word snapped over the quiet crowd like a whip crack. Sophie's stomach dropped. "Son." "Son?" She locked eyes with Agatha, both of them stupefied. Even the pirates looked stunned, still clutching their prisoners. But the lion held his ground.
"There is no son but Tedros of Camelot, the one true king."
"And yet, Excalibur remains in a stone,"
the snake said.
"Until I free it, that is, and prove the throne is mine."
"You will never touch Excalibur as long as I'm alive,"
the lion vowed. The snake's eyes sparkled.
"So it is written, so it is done."
He tore skims off his body, which turned to steel in his hands, before hurling them at the lion's chest. The lion deflected them with gold rays from his finger, then scooped up a handful of jagged ice from the shattered walls and whizzed it at the snake. The shards shot into his flank, shearing away skims and embedding in youthful snow-white skin beneath that started oozing blood. The snake stumbled back, surprised, and crashed through a hole in the stage. Taking advantage, the lion glanced between Sophie and Agatha and dashed for Agatha. He grabbed a piece of smoking wood off the stage and burnt the skims off her, careful not to burn her, too. "Tedros," Agatha breathed. Across the stage, Sophie watched them together, feeling her own heart fill up. For Tedros to risk his life and be this courageous when his people needed it most. He wasn't just a prince. He was every inch a king. Any residue of Sophie's envy drained away, replaced by gratitude and admiration. She'd give him and his queen the best wedding two friends could ask for. The lion freed Agatha and gazed into her big brown eyes.
"Go," he said, "before the rogue comes back."
"No," Agatha said firmly. "We're a team now. We're fighting him together." The lion pointed his gold glow and sent her flying way up the flagpole. Camelot's flag magically came loose and tied around her waist, lashing her to the pole and out of the snake's reach. "Get me down!" Agatha yelled. The lion winked at her and stormed back into battle. The snake rushed him head first, smashing the lion against the pole, before the lion delivered a vicious kick to his thigh, scattering a few skims and revealing more of the snake's milk-white flesh. The two masked men launched at each other, firing spells and skims, shattering two more frozen walls, the remainder of the stage collapsing under their every step, until they were on the final piece of the gallows, a small square of scorched wood. With their bodies jammed together, they could no longer rely on magic, and the two set on each other with their fists, trying to knock the other off the platform and into the fiery pit below. As the lion clocked the snake, a skim crawled out of a hole and snagged the lion by the ankle, yanking him towards the edge of the stage. The lion swiveled and stomped on the skim, crushing it. But now the snake came from behind, hands out, about to push the lion off the stage and face first into the blaze below. Sophie screamed. The lion whirled just in time, belting the snake with all of his might, who staggered backwards and plummeted off the stage, landing in the fire and dispersing to a thousand shrieking skims. Wounded, the skims glowed green and rose shakily into the air, forming a massive phantom cobra in the sky. It hissed at the lion with the promise of vengeance before spraying into the night. Terrible shrieks echoing. Covered in blood and bruises, the lion stood on what was left of the stage, gold mask glistening in the moonlight, his chest heaving. Slowly, he raised his head to the boy pirates clutching prisoners in the field. The lion roared. Pirates dropped their weapons and ran. Students and citizens let out a raucous cry, the forepoint reclaimed and the snake beaten back.
"Long live King Tedros!" someone shouted. "Long live the king!" said another.
As Nicola climbed the flagpole to bring Agatha down, Hort and Dot kneeled to comfort Rena and Beatrix, who were sobbing over their lost best friend. Hester and the witches hurried to the sides of the other Evers and Nevers, many of who'd been wounded in their battle against the pirates. Indeed, the questers were so quick to help each other that none of them noticed that inside the billows of smoke coming off the stage, Sophie was still trapped on the lone wall standing. But the lion had. He strode over the misty crumbles of stage until at last he reached her. His jacket ripped open and sweat soaking his light blue shirt. He burnt her skims away and squashed them under his boot, leaving a puddle of black goo. Then he looked at Sophie through his mask.
"Thank you," he said. "If you hadn't screamed to warn me, I'd be dead."
"Can't have you dying yet, Teddy," Sophie sighed, rubbing at her sore wrists. "I'm your wedding planner."
"Are you?"
he said. His eyes reflected mischief like a hall of mirrors. Something flooded inside Sophie, something hot and stormy in the deepest swells of her heart. It was something she'd never felt with a prince. Slowly, she reached up and pulled the mask off the lion's face. Sophie staggered back. It wasn't Tedros. The boy had tanned skin the color of amber, and copper-brown hair cropped close to his head like a soldier's helmet. He had a strong brow bone, a long straight nose, sensual lips, and thick dark brows that ran flat over his eyes like two streaks of paint. Beads of sweat dotted his coat of brown stubble, and his eyes seemed to change color with the intensity of his stare, from blue to hazel, and all the shades in between. He looked her age, perhaps a bit older. One thing was for sure, though. She'd never seen such a beautiful boy in her life, masculine, sultry, and smelling of salt and sand as if he'd been dewed from the mouth of a desert flower.
"Who are you?"
she choked.
"A humble servant of Camelot," he said, calm and commanding. "Come to protect the king and his princess."
Sophie shook her head. But...
"I suppose that isn't the whole truth," said the boy. "My loyalty is to Camelot, and I will fight until my dying breath to make sure the rightful king weds his rightful queen. But I've also come to find someone else along the way. Someone I saw in a storybook and haven't been able to stop thinking about since. Someone who, in my quest to protect Camelot, perhaps I can protect too."
"Who?" Sophie asked, confused. From inside his shirt, the boy pulled a red rose.
"The girl who's already protected me," he whispered.
He leaned in and kissed her, slowly and deeply, his hands taking her by the waist. Sophie heard herself gasp, his breath filling her mouth, her body lighting up in his grip. She closed her eyes, lost in the softness of his lips, his hot spice scent, and the impossibility of this moment in the wake of all that had come before. His lips slipped off hers. She opened her eyes, and the lion was gone. Sophie stood there in the fading smoke, her heart throttling. A delusion. A dream. Something. But then she felt a drizzle on her neck. She raised her fingers and pulled down the perfect red rose, dripping with his sweat, that he'd slid into her hair as he kissed her. But that wasn't all that the lion had left behind. Because across the stage, as the last smoke cleared, she saw a girl wrapped in Camelot's flag watching her. Her pale, big-eyed face, as shell-shocked as Sophie's had been once upon a time, when another red rose had dropped into their story just like this. A rose from a boy who was never supposed to be in their story at all. Part 2. Chapter 21. Tedros. Allies and Enemies. He dreamed of his father again, staring at Tedros through harsh peacock blue eyes. But this time, King Arthur was taller than he'd been in real life, as tall as the statue of him that Tedros had desecrated. They met on the rooftop of the Blue Tower under gold night clouds. Tedros was in pajama shorts, no shirt, and his feet were bare and wet. He looked down and saw the roof was flooded with water an inch thick, mirroring formless clouds. Only the clouds had a different shape in the water's reflection. They looked like lions. His father wore the crimson robes in which he was buried, his bearded face ruddy and fresh, the way Tedros remembered him in the prime of his reign. Camelot's crown glistened on Arthur's head, and Tedros found himself reaching up to make sure his own crown was still there. It wasn't.
"They say he's your son," Tedros accused. "They say you know who he is."
Arthur grew taller.
"Who is he?"
Tedros shouted. Higher and higher Arthur grew, reaching for the clouds.
tell me the truth, Tedros cried.
King Arthur roared, shaking the earth with his fury. He bent down like a giant and glared into his son's eyes.
Unbury me, he said.
Then the clouds pounced down and devoured Arthur into the night. Tedros woke in a pool of sweat on a cold floor. He pried open his eyes and saw he was at the top of the dungeon staircase, curled up in front of the stone door. How could I fall asleep? He had to get to the forepoint. He had to find this snake now.
Kay!
He screamed, pounding on the door again. But the dream had felt so real, his father's roar reverberating through him. For months he'd been haunted by his dad, but this was the first time he'd been given an order from the grave. An order that didn't make sense. How could there be answers in a heap of bones and dust? All he was left with was the riddle of a dream. But what happened with the advisers wasn't a dream. They'd hinted that the snake was his father's son, which meant he'd be Tedros's brother. Impossible. He would have known. Someone would have told him, his mother, his father, anyone. No secret like that could be kept for so long.
Kay!
Tedros blared, bludgeoning the door. Faint shouts echoed beyond it, as if they were miles away. He'd attacked the door for hours last night, shouting himself hoarse, waiting for someone to open it. It didn't make any sense. His guard, Kay, had left through the very same door. Tedros's heart stopped.
Unless Kay locked me in.
He thought back to their heartfelt conversation on these stairs. Why would Kay seal me in the dungeons? An oily dread coated Tedros's throat. Did Gremlain give Kay her key before she left? Have Kay and Gremlain been working with the advisers all along? Tedros's blood went hot. What were they doing while I was trapped? He battered the stone with renewed force. Shouts amplified outside the door as if multiple voices were yelling at once. Tedros flattened onto his stomach and put his ear to the razor-thin slit at the bottom.
Tedros! The voices called. Get me out!
He yelled.
Key!
Immediately, Tedros fumbled his key ring from his pocket and pried the black key off it. He tried to slide it under the door, but it got stuck beneath the thick slab of stone. Tedros pressed his little finger through the crack, trying to flick the key to his rescuers. No luck. He put his mouth to the opening and tried to blow the key across. A piece of wire surged through the slit, stabbing his chin. Startled, Tedros watched the wire hook the top of the key and scrape it out the other end. The lock snapped and the door pulled open, revealing the shadows of Lancelot and Guinevere.
You know how long I've been in there, Tedros spat, storming past them. Find Kay and lock him in the jail until I return. I'm riding to the forepoint right now. Snake attacked the forepoint last night, said Lancelot.
Tedros whirled mid-stride.
Almost killed the leaders of the four kingdoms,
Lancelot snarled.
Along with Agatha, Sophie, and more than 20 other questers from your school while they were waiting for you to arrive.
Tedros spluttered.
Wait, Agatha was at the... You should have been there. I don't care what the old wizard said. Should have just gone myself when I got word we were attacked.
Lancelot seethed.
But then we couldn't find you.
We've spent hours pounding on that door with no idea if you were inside, or hurt, or dead,
Guinevere cut in, relief boiling to anger. Do you know what you put us through?
Is Agatha okay?
Tedros asked, paling.
I told you not to go into the dungeon without me. I told you to ride with me to the Fourpoint and be a king,
Lancelot harped.
Your father would have listened to me, and not that old wizard. Your father would have trusted me, but you had to do things your way. Is Agatha okay?
Tedros demanded.
Your classmates, your fellow rulers, your princess could all be dead because of your carelessness, Tedros.
Lancelot flayed.
Luckily, someone else came to their rescue.
Tedros felt like he'd been slammed over the head.
What? Who?
Ask the leaders that were saved,
said the knight, pulling Guinevere away.
They're all here.
5 minutes later, Tedros sat at the round table in the map room, surrounded by 20 good and evil leaders.
So let me get this straight,
said Tedros, crown askew and smelling like dungeon.
The snake staged an execution at the Fourpoint to bait me into fighting him. A snake who says he is my father's son and Camelot's rightful king. And then a lion shows up in a mask and defeats him in battle.
Tedros leaned forward.
A lion who is not me.
The onslaught came from every direction.
The snake says he's Arthur's eldest son,
cried the king of Jaunt Jolie.
He says he can pull Excalibur, that he's the true heir,
added the fairy queen of Gillikin.
Is that why Excalibur is stuck in the stone? Because it's waiting for him, not you?
The ice giant of Frost Plains asked.
Even if he is the true heir, you can't let him get near that sword.
The Queen of Jaunt Jolie gasped.
Nearly killed my dear friend and her little boys, said the Duchess of Glass Mountain, touching the Queen with her translucent hand. If he pulls the sword and becomes king, nothing will stop him from murdering us all.
If my sons had died because you failed to intervene,
the Queen of Jaunt Jolie said to Tedros before she broke down.
Thank goodness for that lion chap, said the eight-armed Queen of Uti. He beat the snake off.
And here we thought you were the lion.
The King of Bloodbrook growled at Tedros, swatting his paw at the floating maps that kept bumping into his head.
For weeks, we've begged you to intervene, said the Queen of Ravenbow. Instead, many of us were almost hanged on Camelot land while the king sits at home.
So, according to the snake, you may not be king at all,
noted the vizier of Kyrgios, stroking his gold-flecked beard. Tedros was about to implode. They were all right. He'd ignored them. He'd failed them. He'd let the snake go unchallenged. But not because he'd been sitting on his bum and eating cake. Ever since he'd stepped foot in this castle, he'd tried to make the right decisions, from encouraging the people to forgive his mother and Lance at his coronation, to prioritizing Camelot's problems over those of other realms, to staying behind and serving his kingdom while Agatha went into the woods. Even last night, he was sure he'd chosen the right course. He'd followed Merlin's and Dovey's advice. He'd met with the advisers, trying to get answers. He'd done precisely what a king should do. And it had led him right into a trap that nearly killed his princess, killed his friends, and made him look like a coward. His whole life he'd thought being a king was about doing good. But now that he was king, good kept leading him astray. Tedros could see Lancelot standing with his mother near the door. He'd told them to stay away from this meeting, that it was too dangerous, revealing themselves when there was a bounty on their heads. But Guinevere hadn't listened, insisting her son might need her. Nor had Lance, who was glowering at him, clearly still miffed and surely enjoying the sight of the young king spit-roasted by half the wood's leaders.
"If the snake pulls Excalibur, we're dead," the Empress of Putsy pressured.
"How could Arthur have a secret son?"
the Duke of Hamelin demanded.
"How do we find this lion? He's the one we need,"
urged the Queen of Jaunt Joly. Tedros tried to quell his rage, spewing in all directions. He needed to think. Last night, those three shrews had warned him what was coming.
"At the Four Point, the real story begins."
Somehow, they'd plotted with the snake from prison to trap Tedros last night while the snake attacked Tedros's princess, his friends, and his allies. What must have Agatha thought, waiting at the gallows for him to come? And who was this lion who had saved her? All he'd gleaned is that it was a boy, his age, who'd fought off the villain, then promptly disappeared. No one knew who he was. He'd asked no reward for his efforts. He hadn't been seen since. So who could he be, then? In Agatha and Sophie's world, beyond the woods, heroes came out of nowhere, riding in on white horses to save fair maidens from evil. But not here. Heroes had motives in the woods. Heroes had a history. And this hero seemed to have neither. He certainly hadn't come at Tedros's behest. So why would he risk his life to save a bunch of strangers? Had he been rejected from the school for good and was trying to get his name in a fairy tale? Had he read about his and Agatha's troubles and was making a move on his queen?
"Don't be a never, always seeing the worst," Tedros thought bitterly. "Maybe he's just like you, trying to do good in this world."
But no matter how much he told himself to be grateful, Tedros hated this boy for playing the part he should have played, for trying to do good and actually succeeding, for showing him up like a fool. How was he supposed to prove himself the rightful king when there was a snake in the woods saying he wasn't king and now an imposter lion doing his job? He could feel his anger stoking again like wildfire while more voices shot at him from around the table, sharp as arrows, heckling and questioning.
"Are you king or not?"
"Who is this lion?"
"If you won't fight the snake, he will."
"Be quiet,"
said Tedros. No one listened. Tedros shot his gold finger glow over their heads like a firework, scorching a hole through all the maps.
"I said be quiet!"
Tedros roared. The whole table fell silent.
"Thought there was a ban on magic at Camelot."
Putsy's empress peeped. A map smacked her in the head.
"Listen to me, and listen clearly. The snake is lying,"
Tedros declared.
"He says he's King Arthur's eldest son and rightful heir. If that were true, my father would have had to have had a child before I was born. But my father was with my mother from the time he was a boy at school until he married her, and she gave birth to me. It's impossible my father would have another son. First of all, he loved my mother devotedly and would never betray her. Second, he would have never kept a secret like that from the woman he married, nor from the son he groomed to be king. Whatever became of my father in his last years, he was a good man, and an honest one. All of you know that to be true. It's why your kingdoms turned to him to lead whenever good and evil faced a common threat. But there is more evidence that the snake is lying. For instance, who would be the mother of this supposed heir? Certainly not my mother. And any other woman who'd have borne King Arthur's son would have shouted it from the rooftops for gold or fame alone. And lastly, would a son of King Arthur, the king who fought to protect all of you, be out wreaking havoc and murdering my friends? This snake is not my father's son. This snake is not my father's heir. He cannot pull Excalibur.
His eyes went to Guinevere near the door.
Right, mother?
The entire table turned to her. Guinevere blinked back.
Of course.
The group murmured agreement. Tedros tried to feel relief, but then he saw his mother's eyes shift to the floor, her throat bobbing.
Should have asked your mousy old mum, the advisers had said. She knows everything, no matter how dumb she plays.
But now Tedros could hear the ice giant and the king of Bloodbrook murmuring over whether there was still a reward for his mother's and Lance's heads. Tedros glared daggers at them.
This snake is a lying mongrel, and yet he's managed to divide us right at the moment when we need each other most. Good and evil may be at eternal war, but we must also come together when our world faces an outside threat. Something my father understood and fought for. We cannot let the snake tear us apart. We must join as allies, build an army that I will command, and destroy him once and for—
The door flew open, almost knocking Guinevere and Lancelot over, and a hawk and horned owl whizzed into the room, spearing more holes in the maps, each bird carrying a scroll in its beak. The hawk dropped its scroll into the hands of the King of Foxwood, and the owl dropped its message to the Prince of Mahadeva, both of whom opened them quickly.
Snake and his band of trolls broke into castle, took your daughter hostage,
the Foxwood King read, eyes wide.
Lion arrived and freed her. Trolls executed, snake on the loose.
Snake's werewolves fed three guards to the man-eating hills.
The Mahadeva prince read from his scroll, lion saved the rest. A sparrow zipped through the door and dropped a note in the King of Camelot's lap. Tedros opened it.
Snake knows I'm on his tail. He's coming for Camelot. We'll try and take your kingdom by force. We must meet immediately and prepare for war. Name your time and place.
He read out loud.
Signed, Your Loyal Knight.
Tedros stared at it, speechless.
You ask us to build an army for you,
said the King of Bloodbrook,
when perhaps it's the lion who deserves such an army.
Tedros shook his head.
So-called lion, you mean, because he's lying too. I haven't appointed any knights. My only knight is dead.
Well then, this boy surely took it upon himself to replace him,
said the King of Jaunt Jolie.
Your father had his best knight defending his banner in the woods. For a good while, at least.
He glanced sourly at Lancelot, then back at the king.
In times like these, you need an ally you can trust. An ally like this lion,
who has already proven himself. I don't even know who he is,
Tedros persisted.
Then I'll ride out with a full envoy to meet the lion as he asks,
said the Duchess of Glass Mountain.
I will ride with you, said the Queen of Ravenbow. We should meet the one who's fighting the snake. The one doing a king's job. Count me and my knights in too, said the King of Foxwood.
I'll go, said Tedros.
The leaders turned to him.
What all of you say is true,
Tedros said, regaining his composure.
Whoever this so-called lion is, he's saved my princess and friends in the name of Camelot and is calling himself my knight. But he asked me to meet him, no one else, and I will oblige. The rest of you will stay here in the castle and make plans for battle. If the snake is coming for Camelot soon, we must be ready to fight him.
Lancelot stepped forward.
Your Highness, you won't be safe in the woods alone. You don't even know where the snake is. He could ambush you with his army. It's too risky, more risky, to let this snake spread lies and depend on a stranger to stop him. A stranger we know nothing about,
said Tedros.
When we were arguing about the Fourpoint, you were the one who told me to leave the castle and do my job as a king. Well, I'm taking your advice, Sir Lancelot. I'll go meet this lion, and if he is indeed a loyal ally to our cause, I'll bring him to fight in our army. I'll ride into the woods tonight.
Then you'll take me with you, said Lancelot.
No,
Tedros ordered, for his mother's sake.
You are needed here.
A king must have a knight. You will take Lancelot,
said Guinevere's voice. Tedros and Lancelot both spun to her, surprised.
Lancelot was your father's best knight and champion. Taking Lance is what your father would have done, and it's what you must do too,
said Guinevere, standing tall. Whatever tension was in her face had been replaced with a firm resolve, leaving no room for negotiation.
I can't leave you here alone, Mother, not without him,
Tedros said, still stunned. In moments like this, she'd always chosen to protect Lancelot over her son. She'd always chosen to protect their love first. Guinevere turned to the leaders.
While the king and his knight ride into the woods, I'll work with your kingdoms to build an army. This boy who calls himself the lion is surely right. If the snake's attacks in the woods are failing, he will come for Camelot with a vengeance, and he'll do it soon, to rob us of time to regain our strength. It doesn't matter any more what the king did or didn't do at the Fourpoint. If Camelot falls to the snake, he will not summon councils or build alliances or solicit your opinions. He has no respect for diplomacy, legitimacy, or the truth. Many of you saw this firsthand when he tried to murder you and your families. That is just an inkling of what could lie in store for us all. If Camelot falls, then so will all of your realms. From here on out, we are either allies or enemies. And if we are enemies, good and evil are both doomed. Choose now.
Rulers mumbled to each other, giving her suspicious looks, but Guinevere cut them off.
As for your feelings about me, I was once a king's wife. I know how to execute the work of a queen.
She looked right at the King of Bloodbrook and the Ice Giant of Frost Plains.
And if the bounty on my head is worth more than the safety of your people, then by all means, strike the first blow.
Neither of the Never Leaders said a word. The rest of the table gazed at Guinevere with fresh eyes, as did her son, who knew all too well how easy it was to misjudge her. The only sounds in the room were the impatient tweets of the lion sparrow, waiting for a reply to take back to his sender.